Okay, my guest on Podcasting Softly this week is none other than Michael Galen, the writer of No Escape, starring Ray Liotta, also released as Escape from Absalom. It also stars Lance Henriksen, Ernie Hudson, and Michael. I was wondering now we could sort of jump back to hear a little bit of your background coming into the film business and then eventually writing the script for No Escape or Escape from Absalom as it was released over here.
Yeah, and it was originally called Penal Colony based on a book by, Richard Hurley, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been, so that was like in the early 1990s, probably 1992 or 93 at the time. I was out in Los Angeles and had been working as a screenwriter probably for about 8 years or so. I was in my 30s then. I think, let's see, in the late 20s. I'm trying to figure this out. No, 30s. And I'd gone to film school and was forging a screenwriting career after that. And, you know, I don't know how much you know about the life of a screenwriter, at least in the Hollywood system, but there's a lot of us
right. Toiling
away, and the results of your work aren't normally seen by anybody, you know. So even though I was making a pretty good living at the time, you know, what I was doing was either selling spec scripts that went into development but ended up going nowhere, or was writing, doing rewrites of scripts that they had in development, or, you know, occasionally taking something like a book and turning it into a screenplay. Right. But it's, you know, it's such a long shot that one of the hundreds of projects, literally, that they have, you know, in the pipeline ever get the green light.
Right. So did you?
You know, I was solidly. Yeah. Go ahead.
Did you work on anything notable that did get made that you didn't get credit for? Or?
No, there was No Escape was the first one and frankly the only one.
Right. So all of the rewrite work wasn't on any notable films that got made or.
No. None of them ever got produced.
Wow.
I mean, some of them were my own scripts that I, you know, sold to the studios, but some of them were, you know, rewrite projects, which is really the, you know,
the bread and butter,
meat and potatoes of every, you know, of the hundreds of screenwriters that are out there. You know, this is what you do. You hope that you're going to, something will get the green light. But, you know, the screenwriter is probably the least powerful in the chain of command. You do your best job and you hope it'll go forward. But, you know, it depends on what the studio executives feel. It depends on whether there was a change in the, you know, the lineup for the studio executives or comedy was just a big hit, and you're writing an action film, they decide they're not going to do any more action film. Yeah, who knows? It doesn't make much sense, so you just try your best, and you hope you get a film made, and if you do, then your chances are probably better the next time that you'll get put on something that has more of a chance, but you just don't know. So
it must have felt... Yeah, it must have felt really good after all those specs finally was No Escape written on spec.
No, I just moved to New York, I think, and I'm from the East Coast, so it was like moving back to my territory after being out in LA for, I think it was about a dozen years, 10 years.
Right.
And I was pitching, an idea I had to a couple different people, and I had a meeting with a woman named Betsy Beers, who used to work for Galen and Hurd, and so she listened to my idea, and she said, you know, that she kind of liked it, but she wasn't sure about it. But then she asked me, you know, what I thought about, like, science fiction and action films and stuff like that. I said, I'm a huge fan. And she told me that they had this project that they were working on. It was based on a book, and they had a first draft of it written, and that was written by the other writer that's listed. I'm trying to remember his name right now.
Joel Gross,
right, yeah. And they weren't happy with that draft, so they wanted to know if I was interested in looking at it and working on it. And so I did, and I thought the idea was really intriguing. The book was really cool. The same sort of concept as the movie ended up being, but the book was very literary and very talky. There wasn't a lot of action in it, and it was more about like the kind of political systems that the insiders put together and that kind of thing. So it really wasn't an action film.
Right.
And then the script that Joel Gross wrote was not good at all, and I really felt like I had to just kind of start from scratch, which is what I did. And you know, I'm a big fan of science fiction, action movies. I love the Road Warrior movies, and you can probably see that there's a lot of the elements of that kind of movie or the old westerns in there. I decided to put this whole idea of the loner who doesn't want to be attached to any group, who sort of gets sucked into a higher cause theme in there, and that seemed to work. What happened, it was actually all happened really quickly. I had written a draft for these guys, and I had handed it in, and that had to be around the middle of November, a little later than it is now, because I remember I was home for Thanksgiving, and that's, for us, it's in late November, and I was home with my family, and I got a phone call, and it was from one of the producers on the film, and they said, hey, so just want to let you know that we've given your script the green light. It's going to go into production.
Wow.
And, so that was a great gift. It was a real thrill to hear that, and I was very psyched. In a way, that's just the beginning because, they then had to sign on a director, and once they did that, it was time to start meeting with Martin and having discussions about what kind of revisions would be needed to the script.
Right.
And so I probably did another 6 months of work on the screenplay before they all started heading out to Australia and putting it all together.
Right, wow. So most of what we see, is it pretty much unchanged from what you wrote, or was there further revisions when they began production?
There were further revisions. First, I came out during pre-production, and I can't remember exactly what I was doing then, but it was to just continue to make revisions, and I'm sure what happened was that they were probably doing rehearsals with actors and getting a feel for what was working and what wasn't working, but they were also probably beginning to find locations or refine what they wanted to do in action, the action sequences.
Right, yeah.
And, and so practicalities must have come in, so I was probably doing work like that.
Okay.
Then in there somewhere, then they started production, and I know that they had another screenwriter in there, and I don't remember his name, but he was good, and what he did was really just tinker with the dialogue for the most part. He may have put some good zinger lines in there, and I remember he did put a nice little piece of dialogue in there that added to the depth of it. So that was nice. But there's an interesting story about why I was out there the second time. They were in the midst of production. In fact, they were very close to finishing. I mean, they may have been 2 weeks from finishing. Right. And in the original script, there was a final major battle at the Insiders compound, you know, with the Outsiders making an enormous attack, and, you know, it was really what you would imagine, just bigger and more extravagant than any of the other battles that had happened in the script.
Yeah.
But what happened, a couple of factors started occurring to Martin and to Gale, I think. One was that they were running out of money, and they didn't know if they had the budget to really put together another huge attack.
Right.
But they also started thinking, well, that it was really very similar, you know, because there's a previous attack in the script that happens relatively early on, and they thought that it was just going to be too similar to do another big full-on attack. So one of my big challenges then was to figure out a way to make a satisfying, you know, what do they call it, you know, a culmination of all of this without a huge battle, but still be something that is exciting to the audience.
Right.
And so that's when I started thinking, and that's when we came up with the idea of using this weapon that he had stolen from Merrick,
right,
that giant grenade launcher, like atomic grenade launcher,
right,
thing, whatever it is.
So you basically came up with the idea of having them, you know, they basically set it up so it looks like they've deserted the village, and then and then let them storm the fort and then blow them up from the inside.
That was it. That was really the last minute change to the script that really changes the story a lot.
Right.
But so that hadn't been planned until much later on, and that's why I was down there when they were producing and when I may have run into you with all the other people.
I'm sorry. If I bummed into you, I don't recall. It's been a while. Like I said, one of the big coups was Ernie Hudson come past and said g'day to a bunch of us at one point and said, you know, thanks for your patience and whatever else, because, you know, we'd been sitting there for, you know, you're sitting there for a couple of hours, and when you're sitting up, particularly in Cairns where it's nice and tropical and humid and, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're sitting
there. Did you meet any of the other guys? I had very little contact too, but I remember meeting Lance Henriksen, which was interesting.
Yeah. Lance very briefly, like, he walked past us on the way to somewhere else and sort of said g'day, and a couple of us said g'day Lance, and he's like, hey, how you going, and just sort of kept walking. But
well, you know what's very funny as a screenwriter, and this is, you know, this is obviously my first experience, but I came down there, and as soon as some of the cast members found out who I was, I was really kind of mobbed, especially by Lance, I remember, but Ernie as well, and some of the others. And they had all had ideas about how I should change the script here and there. And the funny thing was, it was always in a way to enhance their character and make it a bigger part in the film, that kind of thing. So I had to tell them I would talk to Martin about that, and some of them were pretty crazy ideas, I have to say.
Not uncommon with actors and screenwriters, that occurrence, I'm told.
I guess not. It was pretty funny to be put into that position.
Yeah.
But going back to your question, was it essentially like the script? I would say 85% to 90%.
That's pretty good.
But, you know, but things happen, you know, and I remember screening the film and being a guest speaker at it, and people asked a lot of questions, and I was forced more than I thought I would need to say, well, look, I don't really know. I think they made that decision on the set, but, you know, the script wasn't written like that, so I don't know why they did that. And there's areas that had to be, like, cut out that I thought maybe explained things a little bit. I don't know. You know, the idea that was either it's briefly mentioned in the film or it's not, but it was in the script, is that this island had at one point been a kind of a resort island that had been abandoned.
Right.
So that's why there are certain structures, like the structures that the outsiders are using.
Yeah.
And that's why there were actually, you know, some old cars left lying around and stuff like that. So people were questioning, you know, if this was completely a remote island, why was it? Stuff like that, and that may not have been clear.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I was, for better or worse, felt, you know, that they had followed the game plan as it was written.
Right. So, I can only imagine, as a suffering screenwriter myself, what it must be like to finally, after all that toil and tribulations, to finally have one come off, be there on the set, and having such troubles as actors wanting to, you know, change their lines and increase their lines and whatever else.
It was a big thrill, and, you know, because it is really frustrating, and I'm sure you can imagine, you know, whether you're being paid or not, the reason, you know, you want to do this. I went to film school because I wanted to make movies. I didn't really start out wanting to be a writer, but I thought that writing was the best way to get me into the industry. But, you know, pretty much no matter how much they might pay you, I can't say I was getting rich or anything like that, but it was okay for a 30-year-old. You know, you want something to come of your work. And so it became very unfulfilling to, you know, be sort of working away in your room and finally presenting your thing, and then, you know, eventually just, you know, going on somebody's shelf. So it was a huge thrill to have something be made and then see, yeah, you know, like, these words are not just in my head anymore. They're being translated onto the screen, and that, you know, that's a very great, fantastic thing.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, you had, you know, it's pretty cool for a first time out to have someone like Gale Ann Hurd, who did the Terminator, and then Martin Campbell, who would go on to do the James Bond films, and Terry Rawlins.
That's right.
Yeah, Terry Rawlins, I believe, cut the film, and he worked with Ridley Scott on Blade Runner, and so, you know, had a
pretty... Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Mm.
And we had a good... I like what Bill Mayhew did, but I also like the work of the art director, and I forget his name right now. But just the design of the whole village and having, you know, that's a very cool functional place. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Now the thing with Martin is he had only really done a few things here and there prior to this. So this was really a big thing for him. And he went right from that to, I believe it was directly to the James Bond films. He may have done Zorro before he did the James Bonds. I'm not sure. But yeah, so that was great. And I really, that was an interesting thing for me because, you know, normally the way I wrote action scenes, they're fairly detailed, but he really took these action scenes and was very creative in how he not just photographed them, but invented, you know, new ideas coming out of what I had written. And so I was very impressed with the work that he did.
Yeah. One thing I really liked about the film was the whole idea of that both camps had traitors in their midst, like the insiders had a traitor in their midst, and so did the outsiders that were basically reporting on what everyone was doing, you know.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you liked that. Yeah, I wanted to try to make it a little bit more complicated than your, you know, just straight ahead action film. So I tried to come up with these twists. And you're right. There was the one in the outsiders that saves him from being guillotined there, right?
Yeah.
And then of course, I can't remember the character's name.
Tom King.
What was that?
Tom King. was.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but he was.
Right?
He was reporting directly to the warden, though.
Right, to the warden. That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad you like that. Tom King, is he? I wasn't familiar with him. Is he more well known in England or Australia?
Yeah, I think he's. He was from his credits. I think he was very popular in British television. I know he did some film roles, but I think he was more a British television actor and a stage actor before that, because most British actors start off on the stage and then they either get a television or film or a combination of both. But I had seen him in some other movies, because I remember seeing him from a distance at one point, but he was more known for some television that he had done that point.
And I think that was Martin's influence. I think a lot of the casting, that he went to where he was comfortable, with some of the English actors that he knew.
The great thing that I got out of the whole experience and then finally watching the film is it sort of joins the tradition of great, what I like to call, even though it's not a conventional prison movie, it sort of falls into the category of prison movies. Yeah, movies like, I thought it was very reminiscent of Papillon.
Thanks. Look, I'm like a big fan of all these movies, and I, maybe I don't get too many points for originality, but I'm sure that I watched Papillon when I was doing research for this, and I'm a big fan of the movies like The Great Escape, and, so in those movies, you always have the different team members that are good at their own skills, and it's very much like sort of American war movie kind of thing. And so, yes, right, I put all that stuff in there, and those are big favorite movies of mine.
Yeah, it's just, the one scene that really drove it home is when he's out there on the rocks and he picks up there's a little wooden crate that he picks out of the surf, and he throws it out to see if the tide will carry it out. And I thought that was very, very much a Papillon moment, where at the end of Papillon, where he throws the sack out and tries to see which way it'll go.
It's a direct steal, isn't it? I don't know who else noticed it, but you're right. I'm sure.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, that I picked that up from Papillon, and it's always been one of my favorite movies. In fact, when I was in film school, Franklin Schaffner was, he wasn't an instructor, but he was sort of like a guest lecturer, and we had seen the film and got to question him.
That would have been fantastic. That would have been fantastic to chat with him. He was responsible for some great movies, Papillon and Planet of the Apes, and all sorts of pictures like that. But one thing I did want to one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about the concierge of Vacation Paradise, Walter Merrick, played by Stuart Wilson, who is probably my favorite character in the movie because of his evil eloquence, I like to say. Is a lot of his dialogue yours? Did you write him that way?
Yeah, I would say most of the dialogue was mine. But I have to tell you, it wasn't originally as sort of bantery and, comedic, I guess, not comedic, but, sort of action hero-y.
Okay.
And my first draft was probably a lot more serious and grim and real.
Right.
And Martin encouraged me to, give this guy a little bit more flair. And I don't think any of the actors did any improvising.
Right.
And I'm not going to claim that I wrote every line, but I've seen it, if you've done, most of them, and I think the writer that they had come in to do some rewriting during production did a few there, but it's mostly what was in the script.
Mainly the line I wanted to know whether you're responsible for or not is anyone you can catch, kill, and eat. is that your line?
I can't remember if that was mine or not. I have to tell you, my wife is really proud of herself. My wife is a mystery thriller writer. She actually has 10 books to her name. If you want to look up Alison Galen at some point,
wow,
I'm sure
we'll do. Certainly.
See her on. But she is very pleased to claim the line about after Merrick throws out all the severed heads and says something like, as you see, I've eliminated all the heads of state.
Right.
Well, that was her line. So
okay.
she gets credit for that.
That's great. That's fantastic.
But as far as the other line, I can't remember whether I made that one. It's so hard now, you know, whether it was me, Martin, or somebody else that came out of that.
That's probably my favorite line in the whole picture, actually. Like, you know, where he says, you know, good food, you know, anyone you can catch, kill and eat.
Right. Then he's talking about, you know, their dental plan, I believe, at some point, right?
Another thing, too, is he's so eloquent right up till the end. I love how he's sort of very controlled and all that. And then finally,
right,
when Ray Liotta breaks back into the insiders' camp and they have a confrontation again, he finally sort of breaks his eloquence and he says, "You made me look like a real horse's ass," you know?
Yeah.
Was that something you were responsible for?
I don't think I wrote that. Doesn't sound like me. And that may be Martin, for all I know. He may have thrown that in. But that's something I'm remembering now. That was an interesting final thing that they did. I believe that in that action sequence when Merrick and Robbins are fighting each other on the top of the thing, I think what happened was Merrick, you know, stabs him with a spear or something, and then he falls off into the water, and that was it. And I think they did some test screenings, and people felt that that was gruesome enough finale for this character. It wasn't satisfying enough. So then they reshot it, and they had him plunge into that, you know, what were they? A bunch of bamboo poles that pierced him all over. So, so that was like a last minute change as well.
It's funny you mentioned
that. Something I wasn't involved in.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I was watching recently an interview with an Australian director, Philip Noyce, who directed the movie Dead Calm. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah, of course. I love it.
But the same thing happened towards the end of that picture. They felt that they did a test screening and they felt that Billy Zane didn't sort of get his comeuppance at the end of the movie.
Right.
So they went back and reshot the ending as it is, where he gets he explodes. So, you know, they shoot him with the thing and he explodes.
That flare gun, right?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, it seems like they. Well, if the villain doesn't get a reasonably gruesome ending, he's not quite dead enough, you know.
Yeah.
So Merrick couldn't just fall into the water; he had to be impaled on a massive like 12 meter spike.
He really did.
Yeah.
That should have seemed obvious, right?
Yeah. But it was funny.
Well, you know what go ahead.
Yeah, I said it's just funny how that seems to be a trend, like, you know, if the villain doesn't have a, you know, we've really got to see him put down, otherwise he may yet still be alive or something like that.
Right. Well, it does make sense, too. You know, you spend all this time hating a certain character, you really want a satisfying end to him, and just, you know, falling off into some water that didn't seem fairly calm, considering, you know, the other brutality that was going around. In this film.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's the only place where that didn't sort of ring true. Did you see the last Bond movie? What was it called?
You know.
Casino. No, not
Casino. Spectre. I don't think I did. Yeah. And I have to say, I'm such a huge James Bond fan, but I've been kind of disappointed by the last couple, so I may have missed it.
But in the last one, he finally, it goes against this particular formula we've been talking about, and I'm going to spoil it for you right now. He gets the villain and doesn't kill him. You know, everything's geared up, and
right.
you want, You want him to kill him finally, because he's been a thorn in his side all this time, and he lets him go. He lets him get arrested and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it was very different from what we've been discussing. He doesn't throw him over the bridge and he lands on a spike or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. But
compare that to, one of the Terminators films, or with, James Cameron, where he makes sure, that the villain gets killed at least twice in most of his movies.
Yeah. But no, I'm with you with the recent Bond movies. I haven't warmed to the Daniel Craig films, and I know they're making more. What's interesting is I read online, not that you can believe everything you read online, but there's a rumor that Martin Campbell has been asked to direct another Bond film, so that would be interesting to see if he comes back to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I haven't been in touch with him, so I don't know what he's doing, but he started with that this whole new take on it, which is very grim, right? Kind of humorless. And not that I didn't like the old 70s versions with Roger Moore, where they were really just sort of a joke on themselves. But and I think they may have taken it a little bit too far with the tone that they're going with now. But
So were you more of a Sean Connery man?
Oh, yeah. That was like, I don't know how old you are, but that was like my era, and I just thought he was so cool when I was a kid, you know? And I loved the films. I loved the way they were made. The director on most of them was great. I learned a lot about filmmaking, I think, from those films. And they were, they had some humor in it, but for the most part, you could take them seriously. And, when it got to the cars that, flew through the air and went underwater and stuff like that, that's when I started losing them.
Yeah. No, that's great, Sean. I'm a fan of the Connery Bonds, because Connery was my father's sort of James Bond. So when I came along, he had all the videotapes. I grew up watching Connery first. Of course, Roger Moore was my era's James Bond, but I was very much influenced by my father. So so the Connery Bonds were always were first off the bat. Ironically, you are the second Michael I've interviewed in as many days that has worked in the industry who James Bond was a great influence on. I was interviewing Michael Davis. I don't know if you're familiar with Michael's work. He's a writer-director. Shoot 'Em Up was the big movie that he made with Clive Owen and Paul Giamatti. But Michael...
No, I don't know.
Yeah, Michael was...
Michael Davis?
Yeah, Michael Davis. He was talking about his early influences, and it was James Bond.
Yeah.
Ironically, and because during that period that when he was young and watching these movies, he told me he actually used to take a tape recorder to the cinema and record the movie, and would go home and listen. He said instead of listening to the radio, he said I'd sit and listen to the movie that I'd just seen, so James Bond was a massive influence on him. And of course, if you ever watch his movie Shoot 'Em Up, you'll see why.
Oh, I'm gonna put that down.
Yeah,
is he an Australian filmmaker?
No, he's an American chap. Yeah, but ironically, his film starred Clive Owen, who I always thought would be an excellent James Bond, but they went the opposite way. They went to
No, I thought he was pretty good too. Yeah, you're right. The interesting thing about him recording those movies is that's one of the biggest things that I remember from back then when I was a kid, is that I never heard a soundtrack like that before. Of course, the music was great.
Yes.
But it wasn't just that. The sound effects were fantastic. The sounds during the fights, it just totally brought you into it. And people weren't doing that then. That was a cutting edge kind of thing.
So, Mike, after your overnight success that took many years to happen, What did you do next? Did you get offered other gigs finally and go on to riches and fame in Hollywood?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I will, I'm going to have to, you know, sort of make a long story short, probably, okay. Because I have to get going in a little while, but it's not very exciting. I continued to work as a screenwriter after that, and there wasn't any great, like, you know, because No Escape didn't win an Academy Award or anything like that, I pretty much continued as I had, prior to No Escape. I, in fact, did another project for Gale that didn't end up going anywhere, and several more projects. But, you know, as I hinted about to you earlier, I just was beginning to get frustrated with the lifestyle. I didn't love living in Los Angeles, and I was just frustrated by the, it was just not fulfilling to continue writing screenplays and not really have any control over them after you turn them in, and then, you know, not have anything happen to them. So I think, you know, I didn't really plan any of this, but I started kind of drifting away from the business. I'd already moved to New York, which was going to be a part-time thing. I moved out with my girlfriend at the time, who's been my wife now for almost 25 years.
Yeah.
And we ended up staying out there. And then at some point, we actually moved to Mexico and stayed there for a year and a half. And I continued to write. I did projects for people like Simpson and Bruckheimer, and I think I did another project for Paramount, but nothing was happening with them. And eventually, I think I just got so frustrated. I think I wrote a script that didn't get purchased, and I'd been lucky. I mean, you know, it's, you mentioned that you're screenwriting now. It's tough, you know. Mm. You never know whether something's going to hit or not, and I had been lucky. I'd mostly been working on reworking scripts, but I had sold a few scripts too, so it was great. And then I think after I spent the 6 months to a year writing the script and it didn't sell, you know, I started thinking, well, what am I doing? And so eventually moved to, after we moved down to Mexico, we moved back to New York, but not to New York City. And we moved to upstate a little bit, a town called Woodstock, which is famous for the big, you know, 1969 festival of Jimi Hendrix and all that.
Yeah, totally.
But it's really, it's up in the country up here. And so I drifted away from screenwriting, and I decided to go back to doing what I started, you know, getting into all of this for, which is filmmaking. So I formed a small video production company, which video was really just beginning to become affordable in the early 2000s.
Right.
And, you know, and I've just been doing that since then, building it and doing mostly local projects, but I've done, you know, a project here and there for, because we get music acts up here sometimes for Dweezil Zappa and for the band Blondie, you may have heard of, and stuff like that. But for the most part, they're smaller projects, but I'm filmmaking. You know, I'm shooting and I'm editing and I'm doing audio and working with crews and that kind of thing. So haven't done anything with the studios in quite a while now.
Well, I mean, you've your legacy in the business, such as it is a great little film which I love a lot. So it's been really cool to finally have a chat with you about it, because it's one of my favorite pictures. And
that's so great. You know, every once in a while, I never know whether, you know, how many people saw this film or not, but every once in a while it will come up. Nobody really. Most of the people up here don't know that I wrote it or not. And it'll get mentioned. Oh, hey, I love that film. That was really cool. And
Yeah.
My daughter, who was too young to see it for a while, she's now older and she watched it recently, so I watched it with her. And, oh yeah, that was pretty cool, wasn't it? All right. So, yeah. So good. I'm glad that there's fans out there. I really appreciate it.
But it's been really awesome, and like I said, I love the flick.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate your interest, too, and please keep in touch, and if you don't hear from me in a little while, send me something to remind me to go try to find some cool No Escape paraphernalia to send over to you, okay?
Awesome, will do.